The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business. On May 5, 2011, Gordon Flake, executive director of the Mansfield Foundation, visited the Korea Society to discuss the history, status, and foreign policy implications of China's relationship with North Korea.
Today, it's a tremendous pleasure to welcome Gordon Flake, who I know is a friend to many of us here in the audience. Gordon is really an impressive individual, a tremendous mind who thinks constantly about the situation on the Korean Peninsula and about ways to build peace and stability. Gordon is the executive director of the Mansfield Foundation, and today he'll be speaking with us about China's role in dealing with North Korea. This is a follow-on to a talk that some of you attended with John Park, where John spoke about the party dynamics between China and North Korea and the relationship to the leadership succession. Gordon will talk today more about the geopolitics and the geostrategic implications of that relationship. And I think he'll be pointing to some of the contradictions between China's approach in the international arena and its relationship with the United States and its handling of the DPRK, especially in light of last year's provocations. He'll explore the implications for Korea-U.S. relations, and he'll also tie it into China's rise and regional role. Gordon has served, aside from the Mansfield Foundation, now for a solid decade plus, with the Korea Economic Institute and with the Atlantic Council. And as those of you who spend time in Washington know, he is very much a man about town and a very great voice on the scene there. And I dare say, with any luck, probably a future ambassador to Korea for the United States, let's hope. But in the spirit of Senator Mansfield and his wonderful contribution, please help me welcome the executive director of the Mansfield Foundation, Gordon Flake.
Well, I thank Steve for that generous introduction, but if you listen very carefully to it, I think you could probably draw the conclusion that I've never had a real job in my life. You know, I've spent my entire career not in government, but in the think tank community, and that has obviously given me tremendous freedom in what I say, but also a lack of direct influence. And so I am delighted to kind of focus today in a very unfettered way on my personal views of the China-North Korea relationship, because you know, for all the decades now we've been focusing on the North Korean conundrum, it's really one of those issues that cannot be solved without understanding China and understanding China's role. And I thought what I would do at the outset is really just kind of look at the historical context to put us where we are today and then talk about some rather recent developments and then finally look at some of the prospects as we go forward. I mean, interestingly enough, if you look at cooperation, or in terms of China as an issue from an American perspective and really from a South Korean perspective in regards to dealing with North Korea, it's a situation of, you know, worst to first to worst again in some regards. I mean, to beginning with, obviously, the legacy of the Korean War, Chinese involvement in the Korean War, where we had a situation where American and South Korean troops were fighting with the Chinese volunteer forces in that conflict. And then when, for a long period of time where, you know, it was the Cold War, relative stalemate, and to a period of time where there was tremendous cooperation with China in dealing with North Korea. And so you've gone from that period of cooperation now to a period of rising frustration once again. Certainly not what it was in the past, but it's worth talking about. It's useful for us to realize how far China has come and to give them, you know, every credit that is due for how far they've come on the North Korea issue. In 1993, in the first North Korean nuclear crisis, which Ambassador Minton was very much involved in during that decade as head of the Office of Korean Affairs in Washington, D.C., you know, China, to be honest, was very much on the sidelines, very reticent to be involved. You know, it was not a member of the KEDO, the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization, was not part of the talks, didn't want to be part of the talks, really kind of sat on the sidelines in every way, shape, and form. Beginning in 2003, China was kind of begrudgingly involved in the start of the six-party talks process. You know, in 2003, they first hosted what originally were three-party talks, which then led into the six-party talks. But then, you know, towards the later part of the Bush administration and the first few years of the Obama administration, or the first year at least of the Obama administration, there was a remarkable shift driven primarily by North Korean actions, right? That had kind of crossed the pale, gone a little bit too far, that really drove Chinese decision making to the point where, you know, U.S.-China cooperation on North Korea became part of the mantra, became part of the highlight of U.S.-China cooperation. If you look at the last, you know, 4 years of the Bush administration, the first year of the Obama administration, you cannot find a speech on U.S.-China relations that do not highlight the importance of U.S.-China cooperation in North Korea. It was kind of, you know, the fundamental aspect of our relationship. And it's useful to note that if 6 years ago, if you would have asked me, I guess we're probably 7 years ago right now, but pre-2006, is that if I ever thought that China would support a U.N. Security Council sanctions resolution on its ally North Korea, I would have said never. You're crazy. You know, China despises sanctions as a tool of foreign policy, you know, despises interference in, you know, other countries' domestic affairs, at least according to their mantra, right? And certainly not with their ally, North Korea. And yet, we now have a situation where China has voted affirmatively for, not just abstained, but voted in favor of three separate UN Security Council sanctions resolutions and supported two different, you know, presidential statements condemning North Korea, their ally. Right. So, you know, to say that China has done nothing obviously misses the point that they've really come a long way. Now, there's a long debate about how much they've done, how much they've actually implemented these sanctions resolutions, how far they're willing to go. But I think it's useful to point out that there was a period of time just recently where, you know, China-U.S. cooperation on the issue of North Korea was very much a highlight of our overall relationship with China. I think now it's useful to kind of step back and look at how China views North Korea. And from my own personal assessment, it strikes me that China has always had three no's in regards to North Korea. If, you know, if you're a China specialist, they have to have the four red flags and the three initiatives, whatever. There's always, you know, some type of a grouping. And China's three no's in regards to North Korea have always been no nukes, no war, no collapse. You know, that's their fundamental priorities on the Korean Peninsula. And those three priorities don't always mesh up well. And so the Chinese challenge has always been how to balance those two and try to maintain all three priorities at the same time, to avoid all three negative scenarios in regards to North Korea at the same time. You know, one would argue that after the 2006 North Korean nuclear test, China began to emphasize no nukes, right, and to work very cooperatively with the United States and the UN and other venues to make sure that there was consequences for North Korea's development of its nuclear program, even to the point of implementing some sanctions. And certainly that gained steam in the first year of the Obama administration with the June 2009 test of a second test of a nuclear weapon, where we passed the UN Security Council Sanctions Resolution 1874. And by most accounts, China began to actively cooperate with the United States in the implementation of that sanctions resolution. So what happened and how did we get where we are today? By most accounts, right, sometime in the summer or the early fall of 2009, China became increasingly concerned about North Korean domestic stability. The combination of Kim Jong-il's health, you know, the stroke he suffered in late 2008, you know, the concerns about succession to, you know, 26, 27-year-old son, and you know, from Chinese own rhetoric and from what they're talking about, they began, you know, to stop implementing the sanctions resolution, to stop cooperating with the U.S. on this, and to decide that they wanted to put their focus on stabilizing North Korea. So among the three no's, they shifted their priority towards no collapse. That was their number one concern. And so if you look at the fall of 2009 and really the bulk of the year in 2010, China's number one priority in North Korea was stability, 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 no collapse. Yeah, they're concerned about war, yes. They're concerned about nukes, yes. Those are priorities. But clearly the number one concern was collapse. And that's where they put their efforts and they put their priorities. And they were actually very overt about this. After the sinking of the Chun'an, the tragic naval incident March of 2010, the Chinese basically were faced with a choice. Do they continue with their overt support of the Kim regime, or do they, push back on this, very remarkable provocation, which by any indicator, any classification would be an act of war, right? I mean, 46 South Korean sailors were killed in an act of open hostility, right? The Chinese decided to, to not hear it and say, we don't want to hear it, but we don't want the briefings, we don't want the evidence, and essentially decided to double down on their bet on North Korea, on Kim Jong-il. So even after the sinking of the Chun'an, even before the conclusions were there, right, the President Hu Jintao decided to host Kim Jong-il, not just once, but eventually twice, right, with hugs and smiles and drinks and a very clear indication that we are with you in this hard time. We're doubling our bet. And as late as October of 2010, my Chinese friends, embassies in the Chinese, officials in the Chinese embassy in Washington were very, to be charitable, but very confident in the rectitude of their approach. They would say, look, you Americans and South Koreans are trying to put pressure on North Korea. We're worried about stability, and we have decided that we're going to back the regime more proactively. And look, since we began this, there have been no more nuclear tests. There have been no more, long-range missile tests. The situation is stabilized because of our approach, right? And they ignored, of course, the sinking of the Chun'an because we don't know what happened there, right? That's a different issue altogether, right? That was the Chinese position. Unfortunately, in November of last year, that position took a pretty big hit, right? Because all of a sudden, out of the blue, despite Chinese, assertions that things were going well, there was the not only the sinking of the shelling of Yenpyeong Island, which is most visible, but also some very serious developments on the nuclear front, right? The North Koreans revealed to a visiting American delegation that they were constructing a light water nuclear reactor at Yongbyon, their own reactor, and then revealed, most shockingly of all, that they had a uranium enrichment program where they actually showed the centrifuges to a visiting delegation. And then you had the shelling of Yongbyon. So it's a 1-2-3 punch all in that month, which really undermined, the Chinese assertion that they were, in the right, that their policy had been very effective at altering North Korean behavior. So December and January of this year was a time of real kind of internal, I wouldn't say soul searching, policy reevaluation in China. Now, you had some strong statements come out of China. You had some remarkable statements from Chinese scholars. Zhu Feng at Beijing University, talking about the Chinese policy being old and outdated and inappropriate for modern Chinese interests. Shunding Li from Fudan University saying that he was embarrassed to be a Chinese in this regard. Because if you talk to the foreign ministry types and you talk to the scholars that had any knowledge, I mean, it's really kind of embarrassing. Here's China being overtly supportive of North Korea, and you have this long list of North Korean provocations which are done, in the face of Chinese support. So, the quick retort, from the Americans to the Chinese was, look, Kim Jong-il, when he met with Hu Jintao twice last year and gave hugs and everything, he knew about the uranium enrichment program but didn't tell you. And in fact, the last meeting, he knew about the plans to shell Yenpyeong Island and didn't tell you. And this despite the fact in both meetings between Kim Jong-il and Hu Jintao, the emphasis on the Chinese side was no surprises, no surprises, no surprises. We coordinate policy, no surprises. And clearly there were some big surprises for China. So I will confess that at the end of last year, I had some optimistic expectations that China would recalibrate its response. I didn't expect that China would abandon its ally, North Korea, but that they would recalibrate between these three no's, right? And I think there was some optimism on the part of the Obama administration that China would recalibrate. And you saw this leading up to the summit meeting between President Obama and President Hu Jintao in January of this year. This notion that China needed to recalibrate. And I think it's actually interesting if you look at U.S. government rhetoric. In the summer, after the sinking of the Chun'an, the U.S. accused China of, willfully ignoring North Korean bad behavior, right? That's one issue. After the shelling of Yeonpyeong Island, that rhetoric shifted dramatically, and China was accused of enabling North Korean bad behavior. Right, and this was repeated in several cases. Admiral Mullen called him enabling bad behavior. In January, right prior to the summit, Secretary Clinton gave a speech where she asked straightforward and in a very undisguised manner, if China had not been so overt in supporting North Korea after the sinking of the Chang'an, would they have shelled Yeonpyeong Island? You know, this direct correlation between the two events. You know, you really can't get much clearer than that. So it's not that they're blaming China for the North Korean actions, but they're blaming China for shielding North Korea from the consequences of actions and thereby enabling their behavior. And in my travels in China, I had to spend a lot of time explaining enabling behavior. And I thought, on the one hand, you know, given China's long history of the Opium Wars, it's very inappropriate for an American, you know, especially, you know, one like myself, to try to lecture China on a drug vocabulary, right? But enabling behavior is a vocabulary that isn't just in Korean, you know, 가능하게 하다, you know, to make possible, to enable, to make, you know, to make it possible. But it's really, it comes and has to be understood in the context of addiction recovery, and American drug behavior. So the notion, and I explain this to a lot of my Chinese interlocutors, is that, you know, it's not that China is responsible for North Korea's behavior per se, but just like a father who has a son he loves, you know, but that son is a drug user, and as a father who loves my son as a drug user, but I let him stay in my house, and I give him money for food, even though I know he might use some of that to buy drugs, and I drive him to go play with his friends, even though I know they're drug users, because I love them and I don't want to walk in the street by himself, and I'm motivated by good intentions, but in the end, I'm shielding my son from the consequences of his drug use, and I'm making it less likely that he will ever abandon, or be able to quit the drugs, right? So it's not the father's responsibility to solve the drug problem, but it's the father's responsibility to stop the activities which prevent the son from being able to address those issues. And so on the policy perspective of China, the notion isn't that China would abandon North Korea or that China somehow is responsible for North Korea's actions, but that China, through its shielding of North Korea from the consequences of its actions, is actually facilitating North Korea continuing those actions. And that's pretty harsh rhetoric. And in the end, I was quite pleased, and I think the administration was quite pleased, with the Obama-Hu Jintao summit. Now, on one level, in the entire joint press conference and joint statement between President Obama and President Hu Jintao, there was only one tiny paragraph about North Korea at all. I mean, Hu Jintao skillfully avoided it altogether. But in that one tiny paragraph, they mentioned the September 19th, 2005 joint statement three times, right? Now, this may seem like a really weird thing if you're not in Washington, D.C., inside baseball, you know, figuring out what's doing what, right? Because for those of you who have followed Korea nuclear issues and Korean Peninsula issues very closely, the September 19, 2005 joint statement is an agreement of the six-party talks, which, to be honest, was never implemented in full, right? It was the process was starting. But also, it's an agreement of now moribund, arguably dead talks. And so why in the world would our two presidents reference this arcane agreement of some moribund talks three times in their joint statement in that one single paragraph? And that's actually a very important thing, because North Korea's core position now for the last 4 years has been that they are a nuclear power and that they must be recognized as a nuclear power. And that the six-party talks, they're happy to have six-party talks, but the six-party talks are about peace and security in the region, not about denuclearization. Yeah? And so if you look carefully, you know, in that joint statement between President Obama and President Hu Jintao, they made it very clear that North Korea's declaration of the uranium enrichment program was a violation of the September 19, 2005 joint statement, the six-party talks. They made it clear that the parameters of the six-party talks were the September 19, 2005 joint statement. They made it clear that progress had to be done in the context of that September 19, 2005 joint statement. And that September 19, 2005 joint statement says in a nutshell that North Korea, again, the core portion of it from a U.S. perspective, is that North Korea will abandon all nuclear weapons and all existing nuclear programs and return at an early date to the NPT in the IAEA, right? So obviously this is not something that North Korea wants, right? So, you know, six-party talks by themselves are just kind of this format, right? But the content, you know, of the six-party talks, which we hold to against all odds, is really that agreement. And so the fact that President Obama and President Hu Jintao, you know, got that together in an agreement was considered to be, you know, a great sign of where U.S.-China cooperation would go. And there was optimism in the administration that then China would then work more cooperatively with the U.S. again in the United Nations. And the U.S. began to seek an effort to condemn North Korea's uranium enrichment program in the U.N. This would seem to be, you know, to use our intelligence terms, a slam dunk, right? It's pretty easy. North Korea declares that they have a uranium enrichment program, you know, which would fall under all nuclear weapons and all existing nuclear programs pretty clearly. It seemed to be in violation of these previous agreements. It would seem to be in violation of previous UN Security Council sanctions resolutions, which the Chinese signed on to. So the notion that the UN should condemn that, the UN Security Council should condemn that, seemed to be pretty obvious, right? You know, open and shut case. Unfortunately, the Chinese view was, no, we did all that we're going to do in the joint statement. We're not going to say anything more in the matter. That's done. Let's move back to the negotiating track. And so the U.S. was quite frustrated in that front as we went forward. And then something else happened, right? We, as a world, became distracted by a whole series of other events which are very much ongoing right now. The Arab Spring, the Jasmine Revolution, as you go forward. And so in my mind, if you look at the Chinese response to the Jasmine Revolution and their own internal anxieties surrounding domestic stability in China and North Korea, it reinforced, which was already something that was there, their real reticence to do anything that would destabilize North Korea. So the notion now that China, looking at the Jasmine Revolution, is going to be proactive at putting pressure on Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un during this transition, during this succession, when they themselves are deeply concerned about the Jasmine Resolution. So the Jasmine Revolution was just one more factor that influenced decision-making in China. There's one other point I should highlight here that's useful in noting. China's relationship with North Korea has always historically been referred to as special relationship, lips and teeth, as close as lips and teeth, and these days it's getting on, so there's plenty of jokes to be had about dentures and whether they're removable or not and the process into the relationship. But if you look at it, the Chinese relationship with North Korea is special, not just emotionally, because Mao Zedong's son was killed in the Korean War among the volunteers, and that the old guard among the Chinese leadership, had literally spilled blood on behalf of North Korea. But it's special organizationally as well. Unique among all their relations, the Chinese DPRK relationship is not handled by the foreign ministry. It's not handled by the PLA. It's handled by the International Affairs Department of the party. So the relationship with North Korea is not a state-to-state relationship. It's a party-to-party relationship. And so you'll find, if you can get a Chinese diplomat aside and speaking freely, they will voice some of the very same frustrations that you or I might voice about North Korea, because they have very little very little influence over that process. Now, if you're a Chinese diplomat, think about this, right? You've spent 15 years in very aggressive diplomacy trying to improve China-South Korea relations with some tremendous success. And in the course of a year, you've seen that all squandered, on behalf of North Korea, backing up North Korean bad behavior. South Korea rightfully, after this 15-year period of China, expected more from China. They expected China to be more supportive of the South Korean position because it was so clear-cut, so obvious. Instead, China refused to hear the evidence of the Chun-An, refused to support South Korea, refused to condemn North Korea, refused, even after the shelling of Yeonpyeong Island, where it was clear, cut and dry, called on both sides, to step back. And so the South Koreans were deeply offended by that. When you couple that with what went on in the South China Seas and the Senkaku Islands and stuff, Chinese influence in Northeast Asia has been dramatically damaged, and they've paid the price. In other words, they've paid the diplomatic price for North Korean bad behavior in that regard. And so if you're a Chinese diplomat, you recognize that very clearly, and you're deeply frustrated by North Korea. If you look at long-term trends among Chinese academics as well, the frustration with North Korea is growing. I think that's kind of set. But the relationship is really not handled by them. It's a party-to-party relationship. And so, as a result, it's the International Affairs Department, the party people, and they're the ones who are most anxious about the Jasmine Revolution and other destabilizing influences in the regime, and least likely to kind of be persuaded to pursue policies towards North Korea that might destabilize that going forward. Let me just touch on one more issue, and then I'll stop as I've gone on for a while, and open it up to kind of a broader discussion and questions that you might have. And that is the question of the day, which is food aid. there has been a lot of attention from former President Carter's visit just a couple weeks ago with the elders, from a very kind of full court press by North Korean diplomats globally trying to get food aid into North Korea, about whether or not we should respond to North Korea's request for food aid, to their claims that they have greater than normal food shortages in North Korea and ongoing. And the interesting thing part about this is that there has been almost nothing said about China's role in this process, right? North Korea, has an avenue. If you look at, again, in a nutshell, I'm just simplifying this very, very simply. They have about a 5 million metric ton grain requirement every year to feed their population. And in a good year, in the harvest, they get about 3.5 million metric tons. Again, I'm simplifying this, right? And so they usually are left with about a 1.5 or 1 million metric ton shortfall, which they meet through purchases, through aid and through assistance, et cetera, right? The United States was giving food aid to North Korea at the end of the Bush administration. In late 2008, the U.S. Agency for National Development, USAID, negotiated a very careful memorandum of understanding on food aid with North Korea, which was considered to be a really high-quality agreement, which allowed for Korean-speaking inspectors. It allowed for a survey to be taken place in advance of the food aid going in. It allowed for a number of measures that would guarantee confidence in the delivery of the food aid. It seemed to be a very good agreement, and the U.S. had agreed to give, I think it was some 500,000 metric tons of food to North Korea. Of that, some 300,000 tons had been delivered. When North Korea decided in early 2009 that they didn't want it, they wanted the U.S. inspectors out, and the World Food Program at the time as well, and kicked them out and said, no more, we're not going to do it, right? And so there's this notion in the public discourse that somehow the Americans are refusing to give food aid to North Korea, But the truth is, the U.S. offer for food aid, it stands there. It was the North Koreans that actually asked us to leave. And it's extremely difficult, as you might imagine, for the United States to say, look, we negotiated an agreement with you. You abrogated the agreement. But we'll renegotiate and come in under a different agreement, right? So if we do go back, it'll have to be under the terms of the previous agreement and providing food aid with North Korea. Right now, I think you've heard in the last month, five or six different U.S. administration officials, including Robert King, the Special Ambassador for Human Rights in North Korea, and Steve Bosworth, kind of repeat this mantra about U.S. food aid, that we will give food aid on a non-political basis, the old Reagan doctrine of a hungry child knows no politics, but first and foremost, there has to be demonstrated need, in North Korea that you can verify, right, in terms of knowing that there's actually need. Secondly, there has to be relative need, more need there than other areas in the world, because we have a world of finite resources, right? And then third and fourth, there has to be, confidence that it's getting to the people who it's intended to be getting to. There has to be transparency in monitoring and delivery. So those discussions and negotiations are ongoing, as well as a real debate in the United States is that we should give it. But I thought I would bring into that discussion the question of China. And just note, as an aside, last year in 2010, China had a 50 million metric ton wheat surplus, a carryover from the previous year. It goes into stockpiles, but they have it, right? They had a 40 million metric ton rice surplus or carryover from the previous year. They also hold $1 trillion in U.S. currency reserves, right? And yet, somehow the notion that China, with its common border of the Dalai North Korea, might, be responsible for or actively involved in North Korea's food issue situation hasn't been broached, right? Jimmy Carter accused the United States and South Korea of violating North Korea's human rights by not providing them food, and yet somehow on his trip in from China, didn't seem to suggest that China might be violating their allies' human rights by not giving them food aid or have some responsibility in that process. And again, part of this is very political. It's a very complex issue in terms of whether we should give or not, which I don't have any firm conclusions on, but I'm happy to talk about that and other issues as we go into greater detail in the future. In the end, there's no question that China remains the key to the North Korea issue. We can't solve the issue without North Korea, but it's one of those keys where you stick it in and it's ill-fitting, and you've got to jiggle it just and right, and sometimes it seems like it's going to go, then it doesn't. And right now, at this point, there's no question that it's the key. It's in there. It's right, but it's not a key that's not turning. And so we're left with a conundrum that clearly will have to be solved as we go forward, because whether it's on security issue or the economic issue or not, this China-North Korea issue, which is continuing to evolve, is one of keen interest to both to us and, of course, to our ally, South Korea. So why don't I end my initial remarks there and then open it up for any questions or discussions you might have. Yes, sir.
Could we just ask you to please step to the microphone? And this helps our streaming broadcast and our recording, which will be available on podcast. Thank you.
My name is Tyler Beebe. I just two questions on the food issue. One, what is the North or was the North Korean thinking in kicking out the U.S. aid food supplies in 09, I guess? And number two, why wouldn't the Chinese think it was a really kind of smart move, globally speaking, to send food aid to North Korea?
Those are both questions I really can't answer with great confidence because they involve decision-making processes in North Korea and in China. And so there's a challenge there. On the North Korea side, why they kicked us out? One, obviously, is they were threatened by, you know, Korean-speaking inspectors. And if you put it in the context of what was happening between North Korea and the U.S. at that stage in early 2009, this is after North Korea had tested a long-range missile, or they called it a satellite, where we went and successfully got the UN Security Council sanctioned, the UN Security Council to issue a presidential statement which condemned the launch, you know, as a violation of the previous UN Security Council sanctioned resolutions. And North Koreans were furious about that, right? So this may have been a political move, and maybe they felt they were okay. They didn't need it. It wasn't worth the hassle. I honestly don't know exactly all the reasons why they kicked it out. But again, they had agreed to the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding, and then they were the ones who asked the United States to cease the project. I would add on there, there's a problem here too, in that some 30,000 metric tons or 29,000 metric tons, which were delivered, were never monitored. We don't have any record from that. So any resumption of U.S. food aid would require that going forward. China, what was the decision on the decision point in China?
Why wouldn't they think?
Oh, why wouldn't they supply
it? Just a smart PR move, you know.
It's really interesting.
You wonder if the thought goes through their minds.
China just last week, for the first time in my knowledge, released a white paper on foreign aid. Oh. It's a remarkable document, right? I mean, again, this is China as it becomes a more of a kind of a regular nation state. And you know, there's in this white paper, there's a relatively small reference to North Korea. And they go out of their way to emphasize that they have given no cash, right? That they have given construction materials for airports, and they have given oil and coal and some other key energy inputs. They don't mention food. And one of the real questions from the American perspective is, we really don't know, at least I don't, and at least not in open source, know how much food China is giving and why they don't give more. I think that's a very fair question. I honestly don't know the answer. That, you know, it would seem to be a relatively easy thing for China to kind of meet that gap. The truth is, and this is very important to recognize, it's a relatively easy thing for North Korea to meet that gap too. If you're talking, you know, 1 million metric tons of grain, right, that wouldn't solve the problem, right? But depending on world grain prices, and they're pretty high right now, and I'm not an expert, so somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that's $200 or $300 million, right? You know, just a relatively small reallocation of North Korean military priorities, right? You know, could take care of a big chunk of that, right? Yeah. So there's a major part of the North Korean food crisis that's manufactured, and one of the real issues, which is troubling to someone like me, I'm kind of stuck in the middle. I'm on the one hand, I'm on the board of directors of the U.S. Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, which issued a report about North Koreans using food as a weapon. It's a very conservative organization, and I'm kind of the pinko commie lover among that group. On the other hand, I'm also on the steering committee of the National Committee on North Korea, which is a much more pro-engagement coalition of organizations that are actively interested in engaging North Korea, and I'm kind of the knuckle-dragging Neanderthal among that group. And I will be the first to tell you, despite following it as closely as I can, I can't come to any real conclusions about the state of the food situation in North Korea right now. I mean, there's no question there's chronic need in North Korea. I know there was a bad winter, it was very cold, but it took place during the winter, where the crops normally aren't grown on a grain basis, and it may have impacted potatoes and some stuff, but that doesn't really make a rationale to me. So the notion that there is, I can't see the rationale as to why there's, you know, this dramatic spike in North Korean diplomatic activity in the fall and early spring to try to raise grain. The political explanations make a lot more sense to me. They're facing, you know, their 2012 year next year where they want to be a great and powerful nation. They have big birthdays coming up next year that they want to have stuff for parties for. So it seems to be more politically driven than not. At the same time, there is need. And yet, not being able to get there on the ground, have a real sense for how bad it is, what the Chinese are doing. It's remarkably opaque. It really is.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Just a clarification and also a question for you. Henry Segerman, Korea International Investment Fund. China has indeed supplied grain to North Korea for a number of years. I don't know whether it's a million metric tons, but they have supplied hundreds of thousands of metric tons. And this has been reported in the New York Times and other prominent publications. China also supplies up to 50% of North Korea's fuel oil needs, which is a tremendous financial gift, if you will. Some of these are outright grants, and some of these are paid for on layaway, the layaway plan, or barter, different kinds of deals to make it more digestible to North Korea. So it's really true that North Korea is very, very dependent on China, and although China may want the U.S. to kick in a million tons of grain here and there to reduce their load, North Korea is very, very reliant on China. So now that's my clarification. So now my question is, about a month ago I was at the Unification Ministry, and I asked them, well, why don't you go to China and say, look, this will be a good deal. Help us do a reunification, and the U.S. troops can leave. I mean, that's been discussed in the press, too. And I was told they had already gone to China on many occasions and tried really hard to get China to help them with their relationship with North Korea and even discussed reunification. So my question to you is, what would happen if South Korea just sort of discontinued the relationship altogether, closed the Kaesong Industrial Park, and the U.S., extended the sanctions to become some kind of embargo? I remember the Banco Delta Asia scenario. It was $25 million was all they had in that account, and the, freezing the assets was very, very painful to North Korea. What if South Korea and the U.S. got really tough with North Korea and China and just said, hey, China, you like North Korea, you can have it. It's all yours because it's basically a failed state. What do you think would happen?
No, this is a wonderful hypothetical that people ask all the time, one that doesn't fit very well with kind of political realities in South Korea. Interestingly enough, recent polls by, conservative newspapers in South Korea showed some 70% of South Koreans were opposed to food aid to North Korea. Even the Hangyae Shimbun, the more progressive paper in South Korea, showed that some 63% of South Koreans were opposed to food aid to North Korea. Now, that may seem to suggest that South Koreans have shifted dramatically in North Korea, and they might support precisely this type of an approach. Just shut down Kaesong, right? There is no groundswell to shut down Kaesong in South Korea. This is something they want to keep their options open. In general, South Korea, wants to be respected. They want to make sure that any relationships they have with North Korea are reciprocal, but they certainly don't want instability in the region. If you look at the immediate response in the Blue House upon the first news of the shelling of the Yeonpyeong Island was, no escalation, no escalation, no escalation. So, as much as I was criticizing the Chinese for kind of focusing overly on no collapse among their three no's at the cost of some of the others, right? The truth is that, no collapse is also South Korea's number one priority right now. Although, I would note that there has been a shift. And in a previous panel, I was here at the Korea Society last December, I think we were talking about shifting South Korean views on unification. The fundamental shift that's taking place in South Korea, and I think opinion polls bear this out, particularly among the government and the foreign policy elite, is that while is no desire to be proactive in trying to instigate change in North Korea or to seek a collapse of the North Korean regime, there certainly is, at this point, no groundswell of public support to artificially prop up the North Korean regime, right? So the notion that was really, very, very persuasive for the bulk of the decade of progressive governments in South Korea, that South Korea should be proactive in stabilizing North Korea and getting food and grain and fertilizer in there to keep North Korea from destabilizing. That has shifted dramatically. Now, in terms of whether it would actually happen or not, I mean, part of the problem here is the U.S. is not going to be proactive one way or the other without kind of a green light from South Korea. The Obama administration has made from day one its number one priority on North Korea policy, coordination with South Korea. And I think that's been one of the great untold successes of this policy. Because if you just remember the Bush era, where Bush and Nomu-hyun were oil and water, right? And divergent approaches to North Korea and divergent views on North Korea fundamentally threatened our alliance. I mean, that was a really rocky period of time. And the Obama administration, partly having learned from that, really has emphasized first and foremost, every step will be coordinated with our ally in that regard. So I have a hard time imagining that at this point that the United States would be very, very proactive in trying to push, you know, a full embargo. You know, the president issued an executive order 2 weeks ago that, you know, basically it sounded like a full embargo. It wasn't a formal embargo. Basically said no imports from North Korea. But that was really in response to, you know, congressional threats to the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement and worries that products from Kaesong would come into that process going forward. But even in South Korea, I think the desire right now is to try to maintain some status quo, maintain stability, not be overtly proactive in pushing it forward. As to whether or not that we could ever make it entirely China's problem, therein lies my real answer to your question. It sounds good rhetorically, right, to say, look, this is China's mess. They made it. Let's let them clean up their own sandbox kind of thing, and let's just kind of cut it off and let it happen. But the reality is that's one of South Korea's greatest fears, right, the fear of Chinese influence in North Korea, to turn over North Korea to the Chinese. And so, you know, one of the most compelling arguments for maintaining engaged in some level with North Korea is to make sure that, you know, that the peninsula isn't once again stuck with a tragic division based on Chinese influence in a region. So that's, again, I know this is not a very, it's kind of a mushy answer, but it lets you know that those scenarios have a lot of other factors to kind of impact them as we go forward. And John, forgive me, but this gentleman here was first right before you, and then we'll go to you in that line.
Thank you very much. I'm Charles Kimball with the Korea Center for International Finance. I'm wondering about the relationship, how you would characterize it between China and North Korea in the sense of you mentioned father-son. I was in China for 3 years from 06 to 09, and colleagues who I spoke to there were sort of thinking of it as older brother, younger brother. But that didn't seem to fit to me in the sense of, well, neither one fits. If you were, why would you let North Korea, your younger brother or your son, suffer so much and not help them with development? And then in your framework of father-son, if it is a father-son, is it a young son? And is there control or is it completely out of control?
You know, I probably was overly black and white when I was criticizing China for not providing aid to North Korea, because China has actually, you know, been – North Korea is China's number one aid recipient. You know, actually for a bulk of the 1990s, North Korea was the United States' number one aid recipient in Asia, at least, you know, if you put the numbers together in that regard. So China really has been very proactive in helping North Korea. But the real question isn't whether or not China, you know, provides aid to North Korea, but whether or not how much China would provide if North Korea is even remotely thankful or compliant or appreciative, right? So in general, this is my view, is that the Chinese have for a long time told us that, you know, they don't have any real influence over North Korea, all the time expecting that we will think they have influence over North Korea, but in reality they have very little. Because the Chinese influence over North Korea is what I would describe as kind of negative influence, right? They have the ability to turn off the spigot, to cut off that finance, which has been key, to cut off the fuel oil, the coking coal, the key inputs to North Korea's economy that would destabilize. In fact, China tried in the early 1990s to put their relationship with North Korea on a cash-only basis. And that led to such a precipitous decline in the economy and rising instabilities, the Chinese quickly altered course and went back to that process. And so the fundamental dynamic here is, whether it's father or son, I'll get to that in a minute, but the fundamental dynamic here is China provides aid to North Korea for China's sake. And China's interest is stability, right? Now, if North Korea had been remotely solicitous of China or compliant with Chinese needs or anything other than the most prickly, you know, kind of ally you can possibly imagine, my anticipation that China would give an awful lot more, right? But, you know, the truth is, The United States has found this out, and other countries like North Korea. It is hard to give aid to North Korea. Even during the, you know, the peak of the Comic-Con and the socialist bloc, right, North Korea was the one country that deliberately, you know, altered its five-year plans not to be in sync with the other five-year plans of Comic-Con, right? They didn't want to be part of that process. And so, you know, the notion that it's all China's fault is also untrue here. I mean, North Korea, giving aid to North Korea is tough in that regard. You know, relationships with its father, son, older brother, younger brother, I think you can make a case for all of them, depending on which academic bench you come from in terms of that relationship. There's a wonderful book out by a fellow named Brian Myers, who's a professor at, I think, Dongseo University in Busan. And it's called, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. Anybody know the name of the book I'm talking about? I'll come back and I'll later on send Steve a reference for those of you who are interested. But his basic argument is that, you know, North Korea is probably – oh, it's called The Cleanest Race. The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. And it's something that was a wonderful essay, and he turned it into kind of an overlong book. But his basic premise is that the North Koreans, far from being kind of a communist state or a Confucian state, are really have focused so much on ethnocentricity and keeping out everyone, including the Chinese and the Americans, and that influence. And they really portray, you know, Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung, and not in fatherly terms, but motherly terms. And that's his core thesis, right? That, you know, and if you look at the words they use, it's, you know, the motherland and the mother party. And so you have these almost androgynous pictures of both father and son hugging and holding to their breasts, you know, the North Korean people. And as such, the North Korean people are poor, innocent, pure, and need to be protected from the worldly influences outside. It's really a very compelling read. The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. Something that if you're interesting for a look into that, I would advise you to glance at, because they'll have more insight than I will between those relationships. John, I'm sorry.
Thank you for your insightful presentation. You mentioned that the U.S. Pardon? Oh, yes, John Koch. I'm a Korea researcher. You made the point that the U.S. and China had cooperated with respect to U.N. sanctions and so forth. You just mentioned stability. My question has to do with probing for proactive diplomatic cooperation, which I had, the way I read the WHO Obama summit statement, that there was some basis for doing that. I don't know whether you probably caught the fact that during the in the aftermath of the Chonan China suddenly said, well, let's let the MAC look at it. So I said, great. Not to investigate the incident, but if we could reactivate the MAC, perhaps we could solve the problem of the West Sea. So to calm the waters, get China back into the MAC. Now, and I tried to push that view on some officials and so forth, but it didn't get very far because, as you said, the U.S. has contracted its policy to South Korea in terms of what it sees is in its interests. And now, because of the tragedy, South Korea is in no position to compromise. But there are, if you look at the problem objectively, there is a solution. And what I'm wondering, do you see any possibility that the U.S. and China would see it in their interests to override this constant conflict that has, you know, tragically wasted lives on both sides? And that would seem to be an opportunity to jumpstart talks on more serious topics like, you know, nuclear proliferation, much more complex topics. This is simply a boundary issue. If they can't solve a boundary issue, there really isn't very much that they can solve. This, you talk about reunification. I mean, that's way off in the future. This is very concrete, practical. If we can get past that and stop these incidents, we might then use that as a building block for more productive relations as we had, you know, envisaged after the communication.
Yeah, I'm not sure I fully buy into the underlying assumption that this is just a boundary issue and it's just this squabble between these two kids in the schoolyard, and somehow if China and the U.S. would just come in and just kind of knock heads together and take care of it, then we could solve the problem. The reality is it's much more fundamental than that. And at this point, however true that may have been at different points in the history of this issue, is much more fundamental than that. And the nuclear issue actually greatly complicates this problem. So if we were having this discussion pre-2006, before the first North Korean nuclear test, then we would have had a lot more options on the table. In fact, one of the trends that it's really important to help understand in looking at the Korea Peninsula problem in general over the last 20 years is it's the land, not just the land of lousy options, but the land of ever diminishing options, right? Because each, subsequent activity or provocation really takes something off the table that wasn't there before. And so right now, the fundamental obstacle to moving forward on the Korean Peninsula, in my mind, isn't the lack of an agreement on the boundary of the West Sea. North Korea has at various times in the last 40 years cared about that or not cared about that, focused not about that, agreed upon that, not agreed upon that. That's much more a symptom in my mind than a cause, right? I don't see that as a root cause. The problem is, and this is the fundamental challenge, how do we engage North Korea in a meaningful way while they assert that they are a nuclear power and that they are negotiating as a nuclear power? Because to be very blunt, the United States has a broad global interest in maintaining the nuclear nonproliferation regime, right, and not recognizing North Korea as a nuclear power, right? Because if a poor, bankrupt, starving pariah regime like North Korea can kick out IAEA inspectors, test a nuclear weapon, declare themselves a nuclear power, and become accepted as a nuclear power, who can't, right? Which country in the world is not more acceptable to the international community to be a nuclear power than North Korea, right? They've never met a weapon system or technology they haven't proliferated or sold, right? They consort with all the worst people around the world, right, in terms of all the things they do. And it's hard to come up with a scenario, even Zimbabwe, right, which would not be more threatening to our interests than North Korea, right? So that is the fundamental crux of the issue, right? Now that North Korea has twice tested a nuclear weapon, and have rejected kind of the six-party talks, at least in the substance of it, then this goes back to why I was saying the strange, religion of the six-party talks and the September 19, 2005 joint statement, where if you're not following this very close, you're like, what the? Why do you keep focusing on this deal? The reason is because unless North Korea says, they could lie, they could just come out and say, we are committed to the September 19th joint statement and we will abide by that in the six-party talks or we'll work towards completion, then at least we have the groundwork for negotiations. But as long as North Korea continues to assert, we are a nuclear power and you will negotiate with us as a nuclear power, then there really is no basis for discussions, as long as that's not part of the parameter of the discussions, right? In the spring of 2010, North Korea proposed a peace treaty. Sounds like a great idea, right? What's wrong with the peace treaty? There couldn't be anything better. We should explore that, shouldn't we? Except for the North Korean fundamental position is, we are a nuclear power. We will negotiate as a nuclear power. We'll sign a North Korea a peace treaty with you as a nuclear power. And maybe one day we'll come back to your six-party talks. You've essentially de facto recognized them as a nuclear power, and there are downstream implications for that everywhere else in the world for other countries who are, seeking a nuclear option. I'll give you another very current example, right? In January, North Korea offered to have unconditional talks with South Korea. Didn't move very well. Jimmy Carter, thinking he's got something new, came out again and says, I've got a note from Kim Jong-il that says he's going to have unconditional talks with Im Young-bak, right? Except for if you step back and think about it, it's conditional. It's conditional, one, upon not talking about nukes and recognizing that North Korea is a nuclear power, right? On ignoring the killing of 46 of your sailors, ignoring the shelling of an island, and the killing of your civilians, both acts of war, right? And let's talk about how you can help us economically. Those are conditions, underlying conditions to the notion of unconditional talks as you go forward. So I'm just saying it's really not that clear cut. And this is why if you look at the wording coming out of both the Blue House and the White House, it's not harsh wording that we'll never ever talk to you guys again. It's that we're looking for some indication of seriousness of purpose, seriousness of intent, right? And as long as North Korea is not even willing to make a reference to the September 19th joint statement or to say that they are committed to, again, here I should make a clear clarification. If they say the word denuclearization, pihekwa in North Korean, that may sound great. Oh, North Koreans said they're committed to denuclearization. Then we should have talks. But the North Koreans have also been very explicit about what they mean by denuclearization. That is mutual disarmament between the United States and North Korea. We abandoned their nukes and they abandoned North. They've actually subsequently gone on to say, global denuclearization. We're committed to global denuclearization, which is fine. But the September 2009 joint statement defines denuclearization as North Korea returning to compliance with the IAEA, the NPT, with 180 other countries which have all signed on to the same deal, right? It's not the you alone get to be a nuclear power kind of deal as you go forward. And so, again, I just want to give you an idea of it may seem simple up front, but it's a really thorny, complex issue as you go forward. Yes, sir. And then we'll go to you, ma'am.
My name is Cambria. Thank you for the discussion. The picture you paint is extremely bleak. It's just as hardline as you paint the North Korean position. There's absolutely no room for maneuver. In fact, if there was a political will, a lot could be overlooked. For example, Israel is our ally, but it also is a nuclear power. It's palatable to us to recognize that. The North Koreans have one. Two, you don't bring up what about the fate of the Korean-American businessman who was taken prisoner in November? And isn't it could be interpreted that the shelling from the south to the north and then the north to the south, it was one way for the North to ensure that open hostilities would not advance much because the U.S. has to protect its own citizenship. I'm heard a different scenario about food, and that was on the Channel 13 News Hour. A man who was with Mercy Corps in Washington said that for 2 years, up until 2008, when the U.S. and South Korea turned off the spigot of food, that there was a protocol that this volunteer organization had with the North whereby Mercy Corps had control of food and its distribution from the point of arrival in Pyongyang to its distribution to areas in the provinces where they were both needed. So there are modalities that could be taken on. It's just that the U.S., as you point out, has put itself as a hostage to South Korea. And it's the same type of policy that the U.S. did when it dealt with Iran, when it deals with Pakistan today, and the same type of policy it tried to occur when it wanted to remove Nasser. So overall, the picture is rather bleak, and the U.S. policy remains, from my point of view, extremely static over the past 60 years.
Let me start with that last kind of notion first. Somehow that the U.S. is hostage to South Korea and we've turned over our policy to the South Koreans. You know, the truth is, the U.S. has placed a high emphasis on coordinating our policy. But, you know, the United States doesn't farm out very much to anybody. We're very proactive in this process. And I think it really speaks more than anything else to a real sense of common purpose and common agreement between the U.S. and South Korea in this regard right now. And here, let me step back. I may sound extremely pessimistic and even hardline in terms of the prospects for solving the North Korean problem right now, right? But if you step back and look at this in a broader regional perspective, right, and you ask, what are the United States' strategic interests in Northeast Asia? I mean, where are our strategic interests, all right? Our strategic interests are not North Korea itself, right? Our strategic interests really are the peace, stability, and economic progress of Northeast Asia as a whole. Right. And I would argue that some previous times in recent history where we have overemphasized trying to solve the North Korea problem, we have deeply jeopardized our relationships with our allies, South Korea and Japan, in that regard. So, again, if our interests are maintaining our alliance relationships with South Korea and Japan, maintaining the overall stability, making sure that our policy is carefully coordinated with China and with Russia, and that the region as a whole is not stabilized, then that makes some sense, right? If you look at the biggest nightmare scenarios that come out of North Korea, there are many of them, but the most frightening is that North Korea somehow becomes an issue of contestation between us and the Chinese or us and the Russians, right? That's the real nightmare scenario. So what does that say in terms of where our economic priorities should be during this 60-year period of stagnation? You know, they should be focused on, you know, trying to make sure that we are securing our real strategic interests in the region, securing our alliance relationships, maintaining the stability, you know, and the peace of the region writ large, which has been relatively successful. It's just not sexy, right? I mean, going to Pyongyang and having really cool talks with the North Koreans, that's sexy, right? But really, that's not our core strategic interest. And so if you're looking at what the current U.S. administration and the past administration has on their plates right now, right? And if I had President Obama's ear and could advise him personally, and I really care about North Korea, you know, how could I go to him today and say, you know what? I see in North Korea today the prospect of real fundamental change and real fundamental negotiation. If you would just give some real political capital to this right now, this should be your priority. Think of all the other priorities the president has right now, right? Could you make the case to him right now that there is a prospect for fundamental change in North Korea if we just applied resources and energy and effort to this right now? There's very little indication on that right now, which is precisely why what you're hearing out of the White House and the Blue House is, look, we're just looking for some indication of seriousness of purpose from North Korea. If we saw that, South Korea would move first. I guarantee you. Yeah? South Korea would lead us down to that, and it'd be very easy for us to go in that process. But the reality is, in the succession of what's going on right now, it's not there. And so when it's not there, what you do is you step back and you focus on your core strategic interests. Not sexy, not satisfying, but I think that's a pretty clear, accurate reflection of you know, where our government is as we go forward. I should say I agree with you completely in terms of Mercy Corps and other NGOs who have been involved in that. They have also been very effective at giving food aid, and on an organization-to-organization level, been very effective at negotiating with and dealing with North Korea. So I would not mean to suggest at all that it's impossible, particularly for NGOs. The key factor here is that obviously that, you know, South Korea in the past has never given its aid through the WFP. They've never had any standards on this past aid. It's just gone straight to the government, right? The Chinese clearly have given this party to party or state to state. Most of it has been on a business level, not just direct aid, but that hasn't gone through the WFP with standards and monitoring stuff. And with the U.S., we negotiated a very good deal, and it was being done, and people were pleased with it. And the North Koreans decided that they didn't want it anymore. So again, I would characterize it quite differently, the notion that somehow we pulled out because it didn't happen. It was a decision on North Korea's part. As to whether or not the Korean businessman was abducted as a way to avoid escalation of Yeomgyeongdo attacks, it's probably a little bit too clever for half for me, but I honestly don't know. I had to look at the timing of that right now. Tellingly, for those of you who haven't followed this very closely, I mean, there was some anticipation that President Carter might bring him out. That really didn't come up on the agenda, so I feel sorry for this. But, I mean, the U.S. has been pretty clear over the last 2 years after several similar incidences to tell the U.S. citizens, don't go to North Korea. I mean, you go at your own risk. I think after Jimmy Carter came out last August with the unfortunate Ajilan Gomes, this fellow up in Boston, the State Department spokesman at the time said, please don't go to North Korea. We're running out of former presidents, you know. And so, again, there's a certain amount of personal responsibility that's involved in the process as you go forward, that thing. Now, as to that broader question is, you know, why can't we just recognize North Korea's nuclear program going forward? You know, obviously, if we were willing to recognize North Korea's nuclear power, we could have, you know, relations with them today. I testified at the beginning of April on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with a very good friend of mine, Bob Carlin, who probably knows, has forgotten more about North Korea than I will ever know. He's a really, really sharp man. And he was asked by Senator Kerry what we should do right now. And his response was, that we should just set the North Korea nuclear issue aside. You know, we can't solve it for right now because that's going to become an obstacle in improving our relationship with North Korea. And he's absolutely right. If our objective, if our goal is to improve the relationship with North Korea, then by all means, we should recognize them as a nuclear power or just ignore the issue for now. But that's not our sole objective. There are competing objectives, right? And a very important one is maintaining the viability of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. Yeah. Where we're dealing with very difficult issues around the world. So again, I would say, how can you go anywhere else if you can say, you know, if a country like North Korea, which is, again, I would reject the notion of some moral equivalency between the state of Israel and the state of North Korea in terms of the nuclear issue going forward. Or, you know, as India and Pakistan, when India and Pakistan went nuclear, many people made that same argument, right, about India and Pakistan. Obviously, you know, real international politics are not fair. North Korea is not India, right? North Korea is not Pakistan in that regard, right? And I cannot foresee a scenario in which anyone on any part of the U.S. political spectrum would take a step which would recognize de facto or otherwise North Korea as a nuclear power. Yes, ma'am.
It's Rhonda Haubin, and I cover I write for Taz.de, Die Tage Zeitung, and for other publications. And you mentioned the UN situation with North Korean issues, but you left out one. You left out the Chonin one. And the Chonin situation was that it was brought to the Security Council in June of 2010, and there was a presidential statement in July of 2010. And the implication of that was different from all others in some ways, because I thought there was an effort at the Security Council to treat the issue in a way that it heard from South Korea, it heard from North Korea. And then when there was activity going on, there was it heard from all the parties. And there was a presidential statement that in fact looked at the positions and the understandings and the evidence of both parties and treated it in a balanced way, said that South Korea blamed the Chonin on North Korea, but North Korea said that it didn't do it and it presented it, and others agreed with that. And then it also talked about having a decrease of tension in the region and solving issues by negotiations. But the response to all that was an increase in military maneuvers in the region by the U.S. and South Korea. And so I wonder, looking at the issue of stability, it seemed that the Security Council made an effort to hear the different sides, to take them into account in South Korea and around the world. There are many people with very serious questions and disagreements with the South Korean investigation. It was not an internationally independent investigation, and there's a lot of criticism of it. And so there's a real issue in dispute, and there's an effort to hear the different sides in the dispute. And so I wonder if if you have any sense that kind of process is something that in fact is a way forward, and that is there some way to, instead of just presenting in the U.S. that everybody accepts the Chonin investigation, to recognize that there's a different view that I think the Los Angeles Times mentioned, that there is a different view around the world, so that we see this more as a set of differences that have to be looked at and understood, and then a way found forward out of them.
Thank you. I appreciate the perspective and the sentiments that underlie that perspective. Obviously, the UN Security Council is not just a body unto itself, but it's made up of member states, and that agreement, of course, was one that was considered to be in Seoul, a great failure, right? And there's probably some frustration on the U.S. side, too, because, really it represented a very watered-down kind of compromise statement on the Chinese part. I would just give a couple of anecdotes that are related to that. Without naming a name, a very senior Chinese official in just the weeks after the sinking of China was in Seoul negotiating on this issue, and was very, very frustrated, because on the one hand, he said, Kim Jong-il told us to our face that they did not do this. And then on the other hand, he turned around and said, but if you'd have been more proactive in negotiations, they wouldn't have done it. Right? So, I will be very honest. I don't think there's a single Chinese official who has any knowledge of this that has any doubt that North Korea sank the Chonin. I am not aware of a single U.S. government official that I know that has any doubt that North Korea sank the Chonin. If you look at President Carter, seems pretty clear that President Carter, for all his apologetic moves last week, said, well, North Korea recognized that they did it and they said they're sorry for it, but they're not going to formally apologize, right? President Carter is pretty clear that the North Koreans were pretty forward with him that they did it, right? And again, I don't have access to intelligence, right? I haven't seen the intelligence, but it's not just the South Korean report, which again, I think the South Koreans have been paragons of patience. They've been pilloried and attacked, but if you look, what would the United States have done? What had China had done if one of our corvettes had been sunk and 46 sailors killed. South Korea took 3 months to do a very careful investigation. It wasn't perfect. The Russians were not invited in. The Chinese were invited in, but there are some reasons for that in terms of trust and intelligence as you go forward. They were both invited, you know, in different things which they rejected, right? In that process. And so, I mean, again, I personally don't see this as much of a controversy. I almost put this much more in the Obama birther category than a serious international dispute, if you really understand kind of the dynamics there. Because when you go beyond just the South Korean technical report and you start asking questions, if not the North Koreans, then who? And then you look at questions of North Koreans' responses before and after and chatter in North Korea and North Korean statements that have been heard afterwards, I think it's a pretty open and shut case. So again, maybe I'm wrong in that thing, but I don't see that as such. The broader sentiment, you know, that the UN Security Council statement was an opportunity to remove tensions and go forward in that regard. There was clearly a U.S.-South Korean response in terms of increased military exercises among allies. But this was done, again, in my main – I cannot imagine the Americans or any other country having been that patient in that process. That was an extremely, careful and cautious response on South Korea's part to something I think we would have been much more forceful in. So to heap criticism on the country that, you know, had 46 of its sailors killed – I think it kind of misses the broader point, is from my perspective.
You mentioned the Cheonan and the Yongbyon shelling, as well as the enrichment program, as three occurrences that caused you to think that the Chinese might recalibrate their attitude towards North Korea and their priorities. But I would suggest that if you looked back to the history of the West Sea, you can see why China might not consider the Shelling and the Cheonan. The northern limit line was not part of the armistice that was signed by North Korea and was essentially drawn by the victor, the United Nations, without consulting North Korea. It hugs the North Korean coastline 3 miles, 65 miles up the coastline, so that the only warm water port in wintertime, Jeju, can't really have decent access to the open seas, and that is really extremely restrictive. And over the decades since the end of the war, there have been numerous fishing and naval conflicts between North and South Korea, just fighting over this northern limit line, which the North hates and detests. And, you know, it's just another aspect of the end of the Korean War, where there was no peace treaty and only an armistice. And I would think that the Chinese probably look on the two naval incidents as rather light matters. Right or wrong, that they're really not that significant. Many North Korean sailors have lost their lives in such conflicts over the decades.
Thank you. I agree with you, and I appreciate that perspective. This is important to make sure that you know, if you look at the last 5 years in terms of Chinese actions, and when they first supported the UN Security Council sanctions in 1695, then 1718, and 1874, kind of in my mind, I viewed these as it's a growing body of international law and precedent upon which any future action would be built, right? And so that would become the new foundation, the new starting point next time North Korea did something. And then along came Cheonan and along came Yeonbyon, and they didn't do that, right? They actually downgraded the response. And so your explanation would really help explain precisely why that is, right? Because they don't view those at the same level. They view those as much more lower-level internal kind of Korean domestic issues. I would, however, caution that the notion that this is just this ongoing dispute that's been a problem since the Korean War, while that's true, there have been instances a long time, the decision for North Korea to escalate at that time and the decision for them in particular to shell Yeonbyon Island, land, the first time land had been shelled, I mean physical land had been shelled since the end of the Korean War, killing civilians, wasn't just a normal part of that ongoing squabble over crab fishermen, right? And the thing that's really disturbing about this is that, you know, Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un visited the district the day before, and there's pretty clear evidence right now that this was part of, you know, a succession process, an effort maybe to bolster Kim Jong-un's military credentials or whatsoever, but there was a decision on North Korean's part for this to be a provocation. You know, so the notion that it is just, it's just part of that ongoing issue, I think kind of misses something that's a little bit different about this one. It's something I wouldn't so readily group in that, although you're right, the Chinese would like to. This, well, we can maybe take these last two. I'll be short in my responses.
I'm Myung-Su Lee. I just wondering that just, you know, the Chinese shifting policies after the November 2010, in your view, is that something that related to the Chinese confidence and also regime confidence and intention to be stepping up as a world leader, in a sense that when we, you know, see that, yes, we just, you know, focus on the geopolitical, just the reason why just China defending on just, you know, North Korea, and regime stability is very important for their regime stabilities as well. But at the same time, if China truly wants to be a world leader and stepping up and seeing all these investment going on in all over the world, and what is your sense that Chinese role, Chinese actually, their confidence and or their will to be the stepping up as a world leader in this context?
You know, the events of 2010 were broader than the Korean Peninsula, and there's a bunch of them that can be grouped together to kind of be viewed in that context itself, right? You know, the Chinese actions of near the Senkaku Islands and the dispute they had with Japan on that, their statements and actions in the South China Seas, and just actions on North Korea. And they're all widely seen as kind of Chinese feeling their oats, kind of rejecting the Deng Xiaoping notion of hide and bide, you know, just kind of keep quiet and keep your heads down. By the end of 2010, I think there was a general assessment in China that they had overreached, they'd gone too far, that they had dramatically damaged perceptions of China in the region, you know, from Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia writ large. And so there's an effort to kind of step back and repair that. A couple of areas where there really has not been much repair work done yet, of course, is this issue of Korea. I mean, there's, at this point, still a lot of work to be done diplomatically in terms of Korea-China relations. Yes, sir. We'll take this last one.
Robert Laidley, member of the Korea Society. It seems that the major motive governing the key family in North Korea is to stay in power. And to do that, they need reliable overseas funds. And at the moment, they have a situation where it's negotiated on a current basis. It could drop. And this perhaps is a major factor in their decision to go nuclear. If you don't have the funds, have a weapon. Now, one possibility to give them reliable long-term funds is to build a natural gas pipeline from China through North Korea to South Korea and give them transit rights payments. And, of course, then it would be a situation where if they decided to be difficult and cut it off, they would have done it. They, if they behave, they would continue to get the payments. Of course, to stop blackmail on South Korea, you would need to build an LNG terminal at South Korea. Has this been considered, and would you care to comment?
Thank you. I mean, there have actually been, over the past decades, several kind of pipeline proposals and ideas, most of them driven by the Russians. Interestingly, one driven by Lyndon LaRouche. It was a big thing for a while. There are a range of similar creative ideas that would you know, ostensibly provide core support for the North Korean regime that would help back us out of this issue. And again, this is a case where I really don't want to sound like this kind of overly pessimistic, kind of, you know, down on everything hardliner. But the reality is, you know, as I've been watching this closely for the last 20 years, and as I'm not quite as smart as Ambassador Minton, you know, what I've seen is a lot of these issues where there were possibilities in the past, but because of actions taken, those possibilities have now been, you know, foreclosed. Those doors are shut, and so the notion now that we would go ahead with that at this time, you know, without some progress on the nuclear issue or the other issues, is almost inconceivable. That said, I do think that there is a great cause to, you know, to continue to have this type of an ongoing discussion. I will dispute the notion that somehow that North Korea, if we could just come out, give them, you know, the funds, the money, you know, that we could somehow, you know, give them a regime bolstering kind of confidence. You know, the premise for a long time was that we could induce North Korea to abandon the nuclear weapons, right? And at this point, it's pretty clear that inducement alone will not work. And it's also pretty clear that threats alone will not work. And so we've got a real difficult situation. If we were ever to get North Korea to abandon its nuclear capacity or their nuclear ambitions, there's got to be the right mix of pressure and inducements at the same time. And that's a very difficult thing to try to find. And obviously, in the light of the context today, it's one that the United States is going to have to do jointly with China as we go forward. So I'll end my remarks there. Thanks.
Gordon, I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to take the privilege of being president of the Korea Society and just ask you to follow up on something that's been implicit or been a thread through your whole talk. You said if the North Koreans had not turned this away, if the North Koreans had not taken a negative action, okay, we have several decades of this pattern. What's behind the pattern? And why do we have this this continuous record of initiatives thwarted, leading to dead ends, turned aside? Any one of the things you've mentioned right. This afternoon. What is behind it? It's like it's a demand side question as opposed to a supply side question. Yeah. North Koreans are not being given food aid by the Chinese, but why is it the North Koreans perhaps are not taking or requesting food aid from the Chinese?
I mean, it's not because the North Koreans are inherently evil. It's not because the North Koreans are just, you know, like to poke the world community in the eye. In my view is it really has to do with the fundamental weakness of the North Korean society. And again, this is simplistic, but in my view, North Korea and the regime in North Korea survives on three pillars: control over the movement of people, control over the flow of information, control over the means of production, right? And this is not, you know, China reforming in the 1980s or Mongolia or Laos or Vietnam, other countries reforming in the 1990s. The fact that there is a divided peninsula means that there's this ongoing competition for legitimacy. You know, and so North Korea has a very difficult time finding the right path to open reform. As you might understand, everything that we want to offer North Korea, you know, to become a normal nation, you know, opening, economic reform, investment, trade, all these things, they're fundamentally poisonous to the regime because the regime is structured on the regime being the provider of all jobs, all goods, everything else, right? The regime is structured on controlling the flow of information because what happens, and we're starting to see this, when everybody realizes, you know, that everything they've been told their whole life is not quite, you know, not quite accurate to be charitable in that regard, right? What happens when people are able to freely move around in that society? And so this is why we've now seen 20-year period of time with the regime taking kind of one hesitating step forward and then two steps back because, you know, they recognize that the regime itself and the way the regime is structured is very difficult. So we now have added to that fundamental challenge this nuclear question where the regime, having failed in every other measure, right, economically, societally, internationally, you know, but they've got now a nuclear weapon, and they've convinced themselves that this is their identity. So I'm increasingly worried that, you know, having wrapped themselves in that cloak of nuclear legitimacy, that it's going to be easy to get the Kim family, at least, to take that off and take it off. And they've been pretty clear about it. And the real danger that we're in right now is that they will perceive themselves to be stronger than they are because of that nuclear capacity. Because we're a nuclear state, we can go ahead and sink a submarine. Because we're a nuclear state, we can go ahead and shell them because the South cannot respond at this point, right? And that sets up a very dangerous dynamic as we go forward, but a very important one nonetheless. And I'm happy to give a speech like this at the Korea Society because I see in the audience and definitely in the staff here far greater minds than mine. And so I'm convinced that this is a problem that won't be solved in Washington, but maybe one that will be solved in New York. And so I'll leave it there.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.